Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Poolside Pass podcast for coaches. Apologies, it's a little bit late going up this week. I've had a few technical difficulties with my Wi-Fi and being able to get this episode live for you. I only got Wi-Fi back online on Wednesday. But here it is, episode 9 of the Poolside Pass. They're going to be speaking to Joel Fink from the Bath National Centre about coaching 200 and 400 metre freestylers. Before we get into the episode, just a quick line from our sponsors, Streamlined.
Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. Okay, so I think it's about time I introduce Joel to the podcast. Joel, welcome. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really well, thanks, Jamie. How are you?
Yes, not too bad, thanks. Why don't we just start with getting a little bit of background from yourself, how you got into swimming and coaching?
Yeah, absolutely. So I obviously am from Australia, hence the accent. And look, I was a swimmer myself when I was a kid, and I wasn't any good. I was very fortunate, and you know, the tale of my life is that I've been very fortunate. But I was fortunate to be in a great club program in Australia, and it was a program that had produced volumes of Olympians and Olympic medalists and Olympic champions, and I mean, I was nowhere near that level, but I did get the opportunity to train with and become friends with a lot of those guys who did do that. And, you know, I was a swimmer for, I don't know, 10 years or so. And I was really good at coming sixth. You know, if there'd been a medal, you know, at the school carnival, there was occasionally a little ribbon or something for coming sixth. But I was really good at that. And so after my career of coming sixth, I left swimming and went to university and did a couple of degrees in various things. And off the back of that, as I was sort of doing a little bit further university education, the guy who was sort of my last coach when I was a swimmer gave me a call and said, "Hey, you know, do you want to come and do some coaching?" And at the time, I really sort of thought, "No, I really don't want to do that. I want to do something else. You know, I've done that I've been involved in swimming for a long time. And, you know, I was probably more driving towards a more academic career and going that way. But anyway, this guy said, "Hey, would you just help me out for a week? I've got a coach who's off on holiday for a week. And, you know, would you come back and help me out for a week?" And that was the same club that I'd swam at for 10 years and the whole thing. And I said, "Yeah, of course, you know, just to help out, I'll come back for a week." And that week turned into 10 years. And then it was in my blood, and I couldn't leave alone. And across that 10 years in Australia, a lot happened. And the club that, again, that I swam at and then was then coaching at went through quite a shift. And, you know, where it had potentially sort of fallen down the line a little bit, it was really regenerated in that time period. And that was, you know, with the help of taking the club to a point where it was incorporated into a high performance centre as well, you know, similar in model to what Stockport Metro sort of used to be, with a higher performing club program and a high performance aspect of that club program as well. And that part of the program was led by a great mate and a great mentor of mine called Ian Pope. And, you know, we ended up sort of working alongside each other, me on the club side and him on the higher performance side. For a number of years, and that meant that I got a volume of exposure to just some of the world's best swimmers. And you know, that was an incredible time, an incredible time of learning for me. Alongside my sort of academic learning, I had the opportunity to practice that in in a real world environment as well. And look, you know, like I said, I got very, very lucky. That was just the situation. And, you know, because of the high performance nature that the program had moved into, that then offered me the opportunity to be exposed to some of the great minds in swimming in Australia at the time. And, you know, there were things like for 5 years, I shared an apartment with the guy who was the head of sports science and sports medicine for Australian swimming. And that's a guy called Bernard Savage at the time. And we had a pool table in our apartment, and we'd spend many a very late night having a couple of beers and talking about physiology and talking about the way that swimming works and, you know, what might come next. And look, it was those conversations and the conversations that I had wider with the community of coaches and sports scientists and people around the body of swimming in Australia at the time that helped me to build both my sort of coaching models and helped to really influence my coaching philosophy. And so anyway, the time came to decide what was next, and I hadn't really thought about coming to Britain, I've got to be honest, but a chance meeting with a person at a point in time, and you know, post the Beijing Olympics in 2008, I was on a plane and headed to Millfield. Truth be told, I had one swimmer in my program back in Melbourne back in the day who had actually gone to Millfield. And so I had a bit of an understanding from that person about what it was, and, you know, and certainly the conversations that I'd had with people around the program were around what it could be. And, you know, that was very exciting for me. And I got to Street in Somerset. I don't know if you've ever been there, Jamie, but it wouldn't take you long to see the whole thing. Because, you know, it's called Street because it's basically got one street. you know, that was a culture change. Going from living in the very heart of Melbourne with a population of about 3.5 million people, to living in very much a rural country town in Somerset. That was a bit of a change, but I absolutely loved my 8 or 9 years at Millfield, and had an amazing time. And I hope that I had a positive influence on the program and left the shirt in a slightly better place than when I picked it up. And you know, that's about all you can hope for. And look, through the various successes of people like James Guy and others at Millfield, I was then able to get the opportunity to move to the National Centre. And that in itself has been an amazing experience for me, to be in a place where you can really nut into the detail of high performance swimming and, you know, really try and help people to be high performance athletes and to get the absolute best out of themselves has been brilliant for me. So that's a bit of a windy way to get my journey so far.
Cool. Sounds like, it sounds like you come across situations where, like you say, back in your home program, where you were exposed to great opportunities that led you to where you are now. So it sounds like a really exciting journey that you've been on.
It's been good.
we're gonna talk today about developing 200 and 400 meter freestylers, just kind of off the back of the good success you had with James Guy and others during your time at Millfield and also at British Swimming. Was this the case of you coming across an athlete that led you to become quite knowledgeable on the 200 and the 400, or was it the other way around, whereas you turned those swimmers into great 200 and 400 swimmers?
That's a good question. Look, Jamie, I absolutely believe that I learn something from every swimmer that I've ever had, or at least, you know, had for a period of time. And, you know, James and I worked together for 8 or 9 years. And, I absolutely learned an awful lot about the implementation of 200 and 400 metre swimming from James. But I would suggest that prior to that, you know, based on what I said just before, I'd come to it from an interesting place, I suppose, for middle distance swimming. When I was a swimmer myself, and when I was a young coach in Australia, there were the, you know, the great names of middle distance swimming: Ian Thorpe and Grant Hackett, and you know, a wealth of guys who were swimming amazingly well. You know, but back when I was swimming, Michael Klim, who was the world champion on 200 free. You know, I swam with Mike for a long time, and that was the point in which I probably fell in love with middle distance swimming, because it was so much a part of the very early stages the later stages of my swimming life and the early stages of my coaching life. And you know, through, like I said, I was an incredibly lucky person. I was, you know, probably in the right place at the right time more often than I probably should have been. But that meant that I got the opportunity to connect with the people who produced those great swimmers. You know, Doug Frost, who produced Ian Thorpe, and Dennis Cottrell, who produced Grant Hackett, and John Carew, who produced Kieran Perkins, and you know, that these guys who were the real original innovators in those events. And you know, I'd say original innovators because they were the cohort of people who, you know, probably moved those events from being what they had been into you know, the foundations of what those events are now. And you know, that was an exceptional learning opportunity and experience for me to kind of understand what drives middle distance swimming and you know, the technical, the tactical, the physiological, the psychological components that make up middle distance swimming, and you know, particularly middle distance freestyle swimming, and particularly men's middle distance freestyle swimming. And there are commonalities, of course, between men's and women's in all of those events. But you know, the true definitions of those things were part of my very early learning in coaching. And you know, I reflect back over 20 odd years of coaching now, and I think, yeah, it's all been a continuous learning experience. You know, Kaizen, we've got it written on our shirt. You know, you have one athlete and you see how they go, and I had the amazing opportunity to be standing on the poolside for a number of years with, you know, guys like Grant Hackett in the water and Massey Rossellino in the water, and you know, that these were Olympic medalists, world champions, world record holders in 200, 400 free, and just, you know, watch how that got put together. And each one of those different athletes would have different physical qualities that they brought to the event. They, you know, different genetic makeups and different potentiation amongst their energy systems and the whole deal. But it was, you know, that was really my grounding in the fundamentals of delivering those events and delivering them, you know, at all levels. You know, in the first instance with, you know, how does an age grouper do it? And then how does that progress? And then how does that progress? And then how does a world-class swimmer do it? And then how does a world beater do it? And, you know, that's probably where I come to middle distance swimming from. And, you know, it's a background that I feel incredibly privileged to have had. And you know, I hope that I can share that now with the athletes in front of me on a day-to-day basis, and some from the past, and hopefully even some from the future.
So yeah, I think you alluded to it there in terms of, you know, that that group of people, Doug Frost, Dennis Cotterill, who moved the middle distance swimming on from what it was. Presumably what it was before, especially with the 400, was perhaps quite a low intensity event, and then they moved it into more of a higher intensity event. Let's just start by looking at the 200 and the 400. You know, what kind of events are there? Because I think there's that, you know, there's always, as an age group swimmer, people always think, oh, the 400 is such a far distance to go. When in reality, it's not that far at all, is it?
No, it really isn't. And look, you know, I can tell you, Jamie, when I was a young swimmer, I thought exactly that same way. Like, I was desperate to be a sprinter. Oh, God, I wanted to be a sprinter. And this is not in any way to belittle sprinters. I have, you know, enormous respect for sprinters. I have respect for the sprinters that I've coached and that I do currently coach. And, you know, but God, I wanted to be one of those. But, you know, I just wasn't. You know, I was way too far down the red twitch fiber end. And, but, you know, the program that I swam in was a massive distance program. And, you know, we did volume and sprinting, which just wasn't a thing. And such was the style at the time in Australia, you know. I think probably was a product of the development of those great guys that we spoke about just before. I think it was really, in the first instance, Kieran Perkins who changed the nature of the 400 free. You know, he was a 1500 meter guy, and he came down to the 400, you know, swam the 400 through his career, but came down to be really, you know, very good at it, and then eventually world record holder in it by swimming it in a way that was completely different to the way that everybody else had been swimming that event to you know, world beating standard before, where everybody else in the past had gone through that sort of process of going out fast and then just trying to hang on. Perkins was an absolute even split when he set the world record back in, you know, the mid 90s, and you know, I think that it was at that point that started the revolution of you know, the permutation of distance swimming, where you'd necessarily to that point, I would suggest, had guys who, you know, probably had the genetic potentiation to swim 50s and 100s, and so probably stuck at 50s and 100s, and you had guys, you know, probably a little bit like me, who had the genetic potentiation to swim 15s and, you know, 800s, which hadn't really been invented yet, but you know, that was kind of where you set yourself. And then if you couldn't do either of those two things, you were a 200, 400 meter swimmer. Whereas, you know, that was the point, you know, in that mid 90s period where people started to transcend. You sort of started to see people come up from the 100 to the 200, and you started to see guys like Perkins come down from the 15 to the 4. And, you know, that really started that emphasis of how to swim the event with backhand speed. And, look, you know, I saw a thing from Thorpey pretty recently where he you know, criticized everybody in world swimming for doing it the wrong way. And he said, you know, nobody's got the guts to go out for it anymore. Like, you know, the two people of relatively recent time who have done it the way that Thorpey was talking about have been James Guy and Clyde Lewis from Australia. Clyde in the semi-final at Guangzhou went out, you know, well, certainly the fastest I've ever seen anybody go out in the 200 free, and you know, somehow managed to hang it on for a 144, which is, you know, pretty good. But you take that in context of the fact that the world record's 142.00, and okay, that's in a, you know, in a magic suit, and with, you know, Paul Biedermann, who was himself an extraordinary exponent of 200 and 400 freestyle swimming prior to the suit era, but was probably, you know, very well serviced given his body type and shape by the suits coming in. And, you know, even premise that by saying, you know, 10 years before that, Thorpey probably had a relatively similar suit and a relatively similar level of potentiation. And, for me, you know, that's where 200 and 400 meter swimming is at the moment. The 400, you've got to be able to finish that. I know that's not possible for every type of swimmer. And I go back to James Guy, and all of his best swims, if you took his fastest ever swim, which is still the British record, I think, and his next fastest and his next fastest and his next fastest, they were all out incredibly fast, near enough to crazy fast. But he was able to finish it off in a type of way. But then, that got him to 343 and a bit. But to get into the 342s, the 341s and the 340s, all the guys who have been able to be in that kind of area in the last few years have done it on, again, a near even split, if not a negative split. And, you see that they're all the guys like Mac Horton, who came down from 1500, Sun Yang, let's just say Sun Yang, who came down from 1500 and who knows what else. Paltrinieri is swimming fast, Deddy is swimming fast, on 400 free, and that they're all the guys coming down from 15 to get that and all swimming it as a back end speed event, and pushing towards that, pushing up the, what I would suggest is the aerobic contribution of swimming that 400 meter event. Whereas in the 200, you see more and more guys who have a really fast 100, like Duncan Scott and the cohort in and around the success in the turn of free, Clyde Lewis, for example, who have very fast 100 meter times and, probably would be considered world class in 100 alongside the 200. And they're the guys who are featuring on the podium in the 200 now at world class level. And, I think, I feel privileged to have been starting out my sort of thought journey on this at the time where that was starting to occur and that transition was starting to happen. And it pleases and astounds me every time I see somebody do it in a slightly different way, because it means that we can kind of go back to our physiological drawing board and say, hey, all right, how did that person get that done? And that's exciting. And the coaching world goes abuzz when you see any of those things, and getting text messages in the middle of the night and the whole deal. And so that's kind of where I see it at the moment.
So you spoke there just briefly about the kind of the contribution of your aerobic balance within the events. Now we're kind of looking at the 200 meter event being more of something that people from 100 might step up to do, and the 400 meter one being from people where 1500 and 800 might step down into a four. Where does the kind of the balance between the aerobic and the anaerobic work lie in terms of when you're designing a training program for those events?
Yeah, another good question. I think one of the things that I learned very early on in my coaching life, centered around middle distance swimming, was that it's incredibly important to get the right balance of the energy systems for each of those events. And that it's the, if we talk about the three predominant energy systems and their contributions, getting that balance right for 200, getting that balance right for 400 is extremely important. But the thing I probably learned that has served me very, very well in the very early days of my coaching, and learnt from absolute physiological gurus like Bob Trafine and others who were working in Australia at the time, was to not necessarily look at the energy systems in isolation, but to look at the way that the energy systems can coexist with each other within the potentiation of the race. And, you know, thinking about how do you get that mitochondrial transfer from energy system one to energy system two to energy system three? How can they interrelate? How can they work with each other within the structure of a race of 200 free, 400 free, to recycle energy back into points and functions in the race where you know you need to change pace or you need to change speed or you know this area requires more kick, that area requires more pull. I want to give more specific answers. So I mean quite specifically, you know, from my perspective, and you know, of course, the physiological jury spreads this information fairly wide, and so you know, I think it's at each coach's prerogative to work out the roadmap that they think they should use. But for 200 freestyle, you know, the contribution of phosphagen is going to be around about 15%. The glycolytic contribution is going to be around about 50%, and the aerobic contribution is going to be around about 35%. As my model would sit for that event. And then, you know, if you take that into the 400 free, you know, your phosphagenic effect is slightly lower, 10% perhaps. Your glycogenic contribution is slightly lower also, you know, maybe around 30%. And your aerobic contribution is obviously significantly higher, 60% or so. And using those type of figures, that's how I would put together the physiological roadmap for my swimmers swimming middle distance events, is to ensure that in each week, in each cycle, in the macro cycle, in the micro cycle, in the micro cycle units, where we're getting, you know, that type of balance in the training program, to have around about 15% of ATP-PC type work, around about 35% of aerobic work for the 200 focus kind of guys, around about 50% of you know, glycolytic or anaerobic type work for those 200 meter guys, and then, you know, 10%, 30% and 60% respectively for the more 400 meter guys. Then, you know, again, I would premise that to say that you know, certainly the cohort of guys that I've got at the moment who swim 400 free probably do it as a come down event. You know, I got a guy whose main event's 1500 but swims down to four. I got a guy whose main event's 800 swims down to four. But I got a couple of guys whose main events are 100 and swim up to 200. And then I got a couple of guys who only swim 200s. So, you know, I got a beautiful mix right now. Yeah. very lucky. I told you, I'm a very lucky guy. but yeah, look, to my mind, that's where those contributions interact. But from a programming perspective, like I said, it's identifying as a coach that we need 15% of the ATP-PC part, 35% of the aerobic part, and 50% of the glycolytic part for those 200 meter guys. But it's also making sure that if we drew that as a Venn diagram, that we're actively encouraging those energy systems to connect to each other and yeah, dealing with the little part that's in between, which is, you know, from a seasonal planning perspective, that's where I think for 200 and 400 meter people, it's a fractionally less linear periodized plan in any particular year. There has to be some blending that occurs between, you know, particularly in between the aerobic and glycolytic, well, anaerobic energy systems at various points in time, so that the two can interface with each other. And you know, that's where I kind of think you get the gold from.
So when you talk about there, that those kind of anaerobic and the aerobic systems kind of crossing over within a session, would that be, and give us an example of how you might put that into a little block of work?
Yeah. So, you know, I would I'd call it a hybrid set. You know, I kind of got that name off the cars that have electricity and petrol, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So something like that would be, you know, we're looking for those sets that will help to push up that MCT4 type behavior within the body and that transfer of, you know, mitochondrial energy from one energy system to the other energy system. And to get that, you know, you can cycle it both ways. So you can go fast work into slightly slower work, you know, like a classic clearance set. Just as a random example, maybe 250s at 200 meter back end speed, then 100 at 200 meter back end speed, you know, on a longer rest period, and then maybe 3 to 5 100s afterwards that are descending out to clear the blood lactic acid that would have been produced during the first set of repeats. And you know, you've got 200 meters of quality there, you've got 3 to 500 meters of clearance based work. And so, you know, you might be able to repeat that set twice, maybe three times for some people, for, you know, senior elite trained athletes, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's different. And that's probably not the best age group set in the whole wide world. you know, structure back. But, you know, that would be the way of cycling it forward. Alternatively, you know, to and, you know, again, stuff that I got from Bob Trafine's work back in the day, but to really create the pathway for MCT4 to travel forward, it needs to be the other way around. So it needs to be the potentiation coming from aerobic into, you know, very low level, i.e. anaerobic threshold, lactic production work, maybe 1, 2, 3 at the absolute most millimole of blood lactic acid in the blood system, and then transferring that into higher intensity work, glycolytic work. So to use the exact same example from the exact same set, it would just be flipping those two things on their head. And instead of ascending out the hundreds, you'd descend the hundreds in. And then you take it again, you know, you could go the 100 and then the 250s and you'd probably get a better result from that, or you could go the 250s and the 100 and you'd get a, you know, an equal variant. You could certainly in my world, and again, come from a place of great privilege, you know, we have every instrument that you could possibly imagine to monitor that and to see whether that is having the desired physiological effect on swimmers. But, you know, simply enough, you could run that set a couple of times at the appropriate points in the season with the appropriate group of people. And you know, then just translate that immediately into racing. So the next race you see that's 200 freestyle, did you see that transference of, you know, depending on the way that you were trying to process the set, did you see it transferring forward or did you see it transferring backwards? And if that was the desired result, hey, you know, you've done that well.
Stuff. So that type of work we were talking about there, you know, it's some of that stuff can be pretty tough. So your efforts where you're really going for it can be pretty tough. It's not really for the faint-hearted. What needs to be considered from a mental side of things for athletes to try and embark on that journey towards the 2 and the 400? Does it take someone special to get stuck into that kind of work?
Yeah, it takes somebody who's not afraid to get hurt. that's for sure. But look, it's the conversations I have with my swimmers who swim those events, that it's a combination of approaching the event by being hard and being smart. If you're only one of those two things, you're going to overperform in the early part of the race, or you're going to underperform in the early part of the race, and the race is going to be over before you know it. So you know, we have conversations on a session by session micro unit basis in the training environment to say, hey, this part of what we're doing now is about getting hard. And that might be, you know, we go El Clasico, which is 3100s, you know, anaerobic threshold work. We do it every single Friday night, and you know, all eight of my guys do it every single Friday night. And you know, the guys who swim hundreds, they do it. And the guys who swim 200s do it. Fours, eights, 15s, everybody. It's the one time in the week where we all come together and you know, genuinely do the same thing. And you know, it's based on some good individual physiology. So you know, we'll have two output points in every week, where we'll be monitoring, you know, where's this person's aerobic conditioning level at, where's this person's level of speed at. You know, particularly if we're in a, you know, a more polarized point in the training cycle, we want to have information about both of those things. We want that information to be specific to the person. But that's just an opportunity to go, right, my physiological data from this week tells me that I should be holding, you know, for the first 15 of these things, I should be holding 59 seconds short course. And for the second 15, I should be holding 57 seconds short course, because that's within my physiological range. Of course, different for every person. But you know, that's where that's at. And you know, you see the guys who get that, and they come in and they go, right, I got to go 15:59s, and I got to go 15:57s, and they do it. And you know, some of them will come in and go 15:58s and then 15:56s, and it's that's where you've got to, as a coach, you know, work out, is that hard and is that smart? Is it hard? Yeah, sure, it's hard. You know, you've said to the person, here's your physiological range, and they've come in and gone better than that. Okay, that's probably going to create some sort of training adaptation. They're probably going to get something physiological from that, but is it the thing that I as a coach and that person as an athlete needed to get from that? Is it the smart selection? Because you know, did that take them out of their physiological range? Did it take them too far? Again, I come from an incredibly privileged position where we can monitor that very closely, and you know, I can say, hey, I can see what you're trying to do. I can see you're trying to win the set, and hey, I'm all for that sometimes, but sometimes I'm also like, no, that's not it, because you're going to get something different to what you need and what I want, and that's not going to work out. You know, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is just ensuring that you get the balance of work, and you know, owning the fact that each of the different energy systems play an integral role in the performance of 200 meter and 400 meter events. You get the guys, you know, the more white fiber, fast twitch guys who you know, they love their speed, they love their anaerobic sets, they, you know, they'll go high velocity overload all day, no problem. And that's great. And then you stick them on anything aerobic, and it's you know, it's a whole other story. It's just, you know, it ain't pretty to watch. They don't want to do it, but you know, it's there for an important reason. Then you get the guys down the other end of the scale, you know, the red twitcher, the slow twitch, who, you know, can come to it, and they couldn't buy any speed. You know, they can't buy race days until they're absolutely rested, and you know, you get it absolutely right, and then they can deliver, you know, amazing things. But they properly have to wait to get it. And you know, but those guys will eat up the aerobic work, and then you get up, you know, the race pace stuff, they're probably all right. And then you go to anything faster than that, and you know, they got no chance, like just no chance. And you know, a few of the guys who go in and smell the gym, you know, and come back, and that's that, it's finished, you know. But again, they're guys who need that. And I think that's definitely something that we learned really clearly in the lockdown period, you know, where our guys for an extended period of time didn't have any access to, I mean, that they could do all the body weight stuff, and they could do the circuits, and they could do the general conditioning stuff, get on a bike, go on a rower, if you guys like going out on kayaks and paddle boards and whatever, to kind of get a little bit of aerobic content into that, not swimming specific but still something. And they all came back, and I gotta say, they came back looking amazing, like, you know, proper incredible shape. We didn't have the opportunity to do things like skin folds and even weigh-ins or anything like that, but my coach's eye, I'm just looking and thinking, hey, these guys look incredible. But the counterpoint is, and then, they could swim and they're all up high in the water, and a lot of it, of course, being the fact that they were just so joyed to be back in the water, and you can understand that, I'm sure. We looked and we're like, hey, have we been getting this wrong? Should we be going down like the sort of old school Japanese path of only body weight and only circuit and only conditioning and blah blah. That has changed a little bit now, but it's the older way to do it. We had to helicopter out of that and go, well, yeah, look, we could do that and we could be better in every training session now, but would we get the significant drop at the end of the season for those guys who potentiate that way? We couldn't get an answer that said yes, so we're back in the gym picking up everything.
So I just want to talk quickly about the tactical aspect of those events before just cover quickly the technical aspects of it. You spoke about how Ian Thorpe went on a podcast not too long ago saying that everyone's swimming the 200 freestyle wrong. How do you think it should be swum?
Look, Jamie, it's as individual as you and I are individuals. I can say back only a couple of years ago, I had basically everybody in my group swam 200 free. That was just kind of how it was. And, varying levels, there was one guy who was like a 145 guy, and then there was a 146 guy and a 147 guy and a 148 guy. And, I was kind of like, hey, everybody, can you take one step forward? That would be great. But every single one of them were different in the way that they put it together. And, that comes from an understanding of a person's physiology and really being able to nut into that. And, I've had guys who have been amazing back end swimmers on the 2 free, on the 4 free, and guys who up the 8 free, the 15 free, guys who can genuinely put together world beating last 50s or 100s or 150s, 200s, whatever, but they don't have the natural speed to go through that first 200, 150, whatever, in that kind of way that they could be competitive at a world-class level. And so it's about finding that tuning point for working it out. But when I coached a much larger group of people back in the day, and when I say coached, I mean helped others to coach people. you need some broader ways of explaining it. And the model that I would often work with much younger swimmers who were looking at, your 10 to 13 year old type people, we talk about both the 2 and the 4, and talk about the 2 in 50s and talk about the 4 in 100s, and I would quite literally use the acronym TALK, T-A-L-K. T, technique. If it's your first 50 or your 100, then hold the best technique that you can, because that will hopefully hold back your physiology a little bit. It'll hold back your contribution. The second 50 or 100, think about arms, A for arms. So how are you connecting with the water in the second 50 or the second 100? Third 50, L for legs, start to build on the legs, start to use the back, the rear engine of what you can do. And K in the last 50 or 100, K for kick like crazy. T-A-L-K, technique, arms, legs, kick. And look, you know, I mean, you could, I challenge you to watch any senior international final and see if anybody does it any different way. But there'll always be one or two outliers. But, you know, most people, that's pretty much the way to get it done. I had the great privilege way back to spend some time with Duncan Armstrong, who was the Olympic champion in the 200 free in 84, 88, I don't know, somewhere there. And, you know, that's... From a tactical perspective of delivering the event, you know, whenever I take on a new 200 meter swimmer, regardless of the event, really, maybe not breaststroke, but I never really have any breaststrokers. So, you know, I'll sit down with them and we watch that 200 freestyle. I honestly can't remember if it's 84 or 88, but it's one of the two. And there's Duncan, and you know you've got Matt Biondi in there. You've got across the eight lanes of that swim, you've got the current world record holder, the former Olympic champion, the fastest guy in the world at the moment. You've got two guys who've been Olympic champion in other events, and then you've got this guy Duncan Armstrong, who's basically never done anything ever before. You know, that's pretty much it. And he and his coach Laurie Lawrence had strategized this thing to say, hey, look, you're probably going to end up in this situation where you're coming up against these guys who are just unbelievably good. So, you know, it's up to you. And there are all sorts of stories about how they prepared for that, and Laurie Lawrence stories. You could do another whole podcast on Laurie Lawrence stories. But anyway, like, you know, this guy had done the work. There's no doubting that he had worked hard to get to the place that he was. And he turns up in the heat of this tournament free, and it was back in the day where it was only heat and final, no semi. And you know, he just gets all in the heat because he knows that if he can get anywhere near the center of the pool, you know, basically anywhere other than 108, then he's a sniff because he's going to work it tactically from that point in time. And they'd evaluated everybody else and how they were going to put it together. And so he goes all in the heat and, you know, huge best time and makes lane six, I think, for the final. And that's great. He's got Biondi right next to him. Biondi had like the best kick, the best freestyle kick of anyone ever, you know, really. Thorpey may be pretty good, but Biondi was, you know, other level and for his time, you know, other level. And, you know, this guy, Duncan, knew that. And so you see the start of the race and it goes, you know, take your marks, go. And Duncan basically misses the start, I would suggest quite deliberately. And Biondi goes in and he goes in to just a fraction of a second after and gets right on up on that lane, right? And he's from there on in, he's got a ticket to ride. And he's this guy Duncan is an Australian guy, you know, grown up with surf culture and, you know, body surfing and all that. And he is just in the wave of this guy doing absolutely no work whatsoever. And he stays there for 75 meters. And then the middle 50 of that 200, he just starts to pick it up a little bit because he's, you know, he's had no energy. He's still probably got all his ATP PC left, you know. And so he makes a little shift up in that middle 50 because he knew that this guy's definitely going to be able to finish. And takes that for 50 and then gets to the last 75 and he just goes, you know, like proper goes and wins this thing, you know. Sucks Biondi in on the turn, the last turn, like sucks him onto the wall so that he can't turn and get around fast. And it's the, to my end, it's the ultimate tactical expression of that event being swum. So yeah, I take a lot from that. You know, if I'm talking to somebody who's probably starting out a little bit on their journey of 200 meter swimming, we talk about that idea of 75, 50 and 75. You know, 75 meters of setting it up, 50 meters of making your move, and then 75 meters of getting tough. You know, you can qualify that into be smart, be a great swimmer, and then be hard as hell. And you know, you get those three things together and you've got a pretty good combination. The 400, you know, look, if I take on a new 400 meter person, we'll start from the back of the race and work forward. So, you know, my first interest and the first time I see them go out and swim will be, how fast can you swim the last 100? And what's the total time? And then the next time it will be, how fast can you swim the last 200? And what's the total time? How fast can you swim the last 300? And what's the total time? And then any number of iterations of that, you know, for that person, does it need to be 200, 200? Does it need to be 150, 250? Does it need to be 250, 150? You know, how are they going to swim that? But, you know, based on the same set of fundamentals, you know, set it up technically, take it under your arms, conserve the legs, and then kick like crazy at the end, because you don't never see anybody finish a 400 freeze not kicking like crazy.
Absolutely. Awesome. So just want to finish real quick with some technical aspects. You know, there's loads of different ways to swim freestyle. You've got your straight arm, you've got your hybrid, you've got your high elbow, nice technical stroke. Which one of these do you think just lends itself a little bit more to the types of events we've been talking about today?
Yeah, the three-quarter catch-up freestyle, you know, the Aussie freestyle, I suppose. You know, people have been telling me for the last 12 years that I coach Aussie freestyle. I'm sure that's a compliment. you know, maybe. I'd like to think that at some point in time it'll become British freestyle, but, you know, I suppose I've probably got a while to wait yet. yeah, but the mechanics of three-quarter catch-up seem to lend themselves very well to 200 free and 400 free. You know, probably slightly more to 400 free, and it's a slightly more polarized catch up for 200 free, but I would suggest it's only fractional. So, you know, with that, what you're thinking about is the arm that's going in on the non-breathing side. So, you know, if you're breathing right, we're talking about the left arm. That needs to create its catch position in the second and third quartile of the stroke. Whereas the arm on your breathing side, again, if you're breathing to the right, then it's your right arm. As that goes into the water, because of the fact that it's going to have a longer period of time to be in place, you want to try and catch that one in the first and second, first or second quartile of the catch position in. But if you're able to manage that, you know, that one, let's assume it's your right, is connecting in that first and second, and the other one's connecting in the third or fourth. That gives you the rhythm to be able to swim the stroke. Once you've got a rhythm available to you to swim the stroke, you can integrate the kick into that rhythm. Once you've integrated the kick into the rhythm, you've got an opportunity to be able to change pace, gear, speed within a race. And, you know, particularly for the 400 meter people, we know that that's how it has to be. And for the 200 meter people, you know, it's both finding that rhythm, but then finding a way to best express that rhythm by evaluating what's your distance per stroke or distance per stroke cycle, what's your stroke rate. Can we increase stroke rate without a change to distance per stroke cycle? Or if that changes distance per stroke cycle, which one of those variables is more appropriate for you to therefore produce speed? So from a technical aspect, that's where I'm looking. Of course, you know, you've got to be a great turner. I look at someone like Mac Horton, who, you know, in 2015 probably wasn't the best turn protagonist in the world. and just went to work on that. And you look at his turns in 2016, and that they were amazing. You know, clearly things like turns, if you've developed that skill and if it's something that you're focused on, the output of what you can get in a 400 is dramatically increased. And you know, in a 200, that the skill quotient of the turn becomes a tactical element as well. You know, you look at Ryan Lochte and others over the years who have experimented with different styles of turn in a 200 to excellent effect. And so, you know, that becomes both a skill and a tactical element to that. You got to take a look at the hypoxic quality of what's happening in and around turns. You know, are you a person who is an excellent protagonist of underwater fly kick, in which case, you know, you might have to deal with the hypoxic cost of that. Are you not necessarily particularly good at that, in which case the increased hypoxic cost has a negative effect on your overall performance.
And, yeah.
So yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff.
Cool. Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you today about middle distance freestyle. Certainly a lot in there for me to kind of unpack when I go away from this interview. I just want to finish with a bit of a quick fire thing. We always ask our guests to kind of sum up their topic in three key points. So what would be your quick fire top 3 points for developing world-class middle distance freestyle swimmers?
Point one, physiological, look at the space in between the energy systems. Point two, technical, you know, if you can find the right shape to swim, you are going to be a better swimmer. And, you know, every shape you make in the water times it by three, and that's the volume of resistance. So the smaller the better in that area. Number three, yeah, be prepared to do the work for it. You know, go all in, because if you're going to be the best in the world, if you're going to compete with the best in the world, then there's no half measures. Go all in.
Absolutely. Awesome. Joel, thank you very much for your time today. Pleasure to speak to you. And like I say, lots for me to unpack after this conversation. Thank you very much.
Beauty, Jamie. Good on you, mate.
Take care.
Cheers.
So if you enjoyed that episode there with Joel talking about 200 and 400 meter freestylers, please make sure you share it with other coaches within your network. I want to get these podcasts out to as many coaches as possible, especially as we head into a second lockdown, especially in England. And make sure you check out our social media. We're at the Poolside Pass on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And of course, our website, www.thepoolsidepass.com. Until next time, take care.